So this halacha, namely that in order to shech, that we require Kabbalah, and also a person gets a ksav Kabbalah from the chacham, that he's an expert both in the hilta shechita and also technically in the maisa shechita, that he can do it. That also indicates that the position of a shoychet was transformed into mini hakol. This was true in Europe. There was the rav, but second to the rav, the person had a shayla. There was the rav, the dayan, and there was the shoychet. And the shoychet was the talmid chacham. It was a yerushalmayim v'rabim. He was constantly studying as Shulchan Aruch requires the hilchas. Hilcha Shechita, so that became a mini hakol, and therefore it may be, the Rav suggested, that the reason the minig is that noshim einim shochtos, because since it requires minui, and we have the halacha according to the Ram Melech Lo Malka, so therefore as the position was elevated, so to speak, to a mini hakol, noshim were excluded. Proof to this, the Rav quoted, is that the Beis Yosef quotes, I think it's from the Kalbon, and Rishonim, I think maybe a Mordechai as well, that even the meaning is that Noshim Einam Shochtos, but they can Shecht La'atzman. So if the reason, why this dichotomy? La'atzman they can, but La'cherim not. So the Rav said, if the halacha was, that's a Shaila, that they're not Mukhshah to do it, because maybe a Chshash, I mean it's Aleph, they may faint, or for whatever other reason, they're not as expert in it, so then there's no chiluk ben amla ben atzman and la'achayim. I mean, they're muzur in the isa nevela. But if it's a mini hakol, you understand very well that there could be a distinction between la'achayim and la'atzman.
Didn't like the baker and the butcher also need to have a hefsher from the kal to do it?
Yeah, they're not the same thing. No, the book and the baker and the butcher and the candlestick maker, you know, you have to make sure that, you know, they're doing something that's correct. And everything that the Aruch HaShulchan quotes from the Rambam, that even though we say Eidach HaNem Besum, just to confirm what you said, if somebody opens up a store to sell for the public, he should not, at least l'chatchila, not give the hashkocha, so to speak, the largest Eidach HaNem Besum, that the community should send up some kind of system, a vad, you know, to check him. But that doesn't mean that a baker is a mina hakol. It just means you technically, you know, you want to know that it's kosher. So in terms of the nemonis for that, we the community sets up a system. But that's not a mina hakol for baking. We don't appoint you to be the community baker. As a matter of fact, it says here that if the call, we'll see in Shulchan Aruch, it says later on that if the call says, you know, hitilchem, that only one person should shecht, or a particular person shecht, that somebody else shechts, even though he's a mumcha, so according to some, the shechitas is nevela, that we don't the shechitas is not kosher. Why should that be? But that l'choy, that point of love is because what emerged is this mini hakol, and the only ones qualified are those who are in the smaller yidei hakol, and you see all this whole halachim that by shechitul mashal, even the time of Chazal, that the shoychit has to show the sakin to the chacham. I mean, why all that? Because shechita is a very sensitive issue. You know, in a lot of inyanim and kashrus, I mean, I always say that when we deal with issues at the OU, we have hundreds of thousands of products on the OU. Thousands, I think something like 8,000 factories under OU supervision in 80 countries. But you rarely come across a deraisa, because most of these issues we're dealing with are drabonim. Where do you come across the devices? You come across them when you're dealing with meat. So therefore, it became a minyan call. This, I think, is an important concept on two levels. I want to just tell you an interesting tshuva that Rav Moshe Feinstein has. There was, he doesn't mention the name of the woman, but there was a Rebbetzin Zemba in Chicago. Her husband died. He used to give hashgachas. When he died, so in order to have some panosha, she wanted to take over his hashgachas. And the shaila was, is she allowed to? Melech v'lo malka, according to the Ram. Maybe that's a mini hakol. So, I mean, if you would have asked me, I would have said, what's the mini hakol? It's like you said about the baker, you know, Erecha Nembi Surim, applying to women, applies to everybody. So she's just sending the mashgiach, or she is the mashgiach. Why not? So the Moshe deals with the shaila, and he says, no, don't say that this is not Surim, there's no minui. There is minui, but Rav Moshe, interestingly, he sort of puts aside the Shita of Rambam, and he says there are other Rishonim, the Chinuch, and there could be other Rishonim who don't hold like the Rambam, namely that it doesn't mean that every Svara requires this principle applies to. Yeah.
Does the Rambam explicitly talk about women doing Shita?
No. The Rambam says explicitly that women can do Shita.
Can or cannot?
Can. This minute, I'm saying that's what I'm trying to. That, you know, there was at some point when they began to acquire this, the Ramo indicates that it required Kabbalah and so on. So at that point, or some point in, you know, I'm not sure the exact chronology, that's when it was transformed into called the Mini Hakol. In other words, it became considered, you became considered a communal functionary.
Is it uniformal for Sephardim and Ashkenazim, or just?
Well, no, this is a Chumah de Ramos, so Sephardim, I mean, I don't know what Sephardim do, Lamaisa, where they have women shochet, I don't think they do. But this halacha started with the Hilchas Eretz Yisrael. It's quoted by the Mordechai. The Hilchas Eretz Yisrael was a very strange, enigmatic figure. He appeared in the time of the Gaonim. His name was Eldad Hadoni, and he claimed that he was a descendant of the 10 tribes. You can guess which one. Eldad Hadoni came from Don, and that he came from the other side of the Sambat Yon River with many new halachas that he stated, and amongst them was this, that he had many that relates to Hilchas Shechita. One was that women shouldn't shecht. Now, he was a mysterious figure, and even in that period there are those who thought he was a fraud. Which he might very well have been, but some of his halachas, which he said, they call that Hilchas Eretz Yisrael. So this, the original source, so to speak, of this, that Noshim Don Shecht, is from the Hilchas Eretz Yisrael. He has a whole list of other things that if you don't make a bloch on the Shechita, that it passes the Shechita. Tosis quotes it in Zvachim. But amongst them is this Hilchas Eretz Yisrael, is that women shouldn't shecht. As a matter of fact, I heard from the Rav that he said, some say that, you know, it's always a Rosh Tevis, Hilchas Aleph Yud, which we presume to be Hilchas Eretz Yisrael. But the Rav said there are those who say that it might not be Hilchas, stand for Hilchas Eretz Yisrael, but it might be, some thought it was Hilchas Amo Yehoshua. Because whenever things Eldad Adoni would say, he would try to show he had a Kabbalah all the way back, and used to say, Til Yehoshua Binun. So they call him Hilchas Amo Yehoshua. The principle that I want to garner from this tshuva for a Moshe is interesting, because you just a sense of responsibility that people should have when they come to Inyoni Kashrus, even beyond Shechita, that, you know, this is a Minui Hakol. You're responsible to the community. So, there's a much greater level of achrayus that people should have as they deal with these issues. And I think that's what underpins with Moshe's opinion. This may, by the way, have consequences to other issues that are, you know, emerged of late in terms of women, in terms of communal positions. It's interesting that somebody wrote a shaila to Moshe, Rabbi Shapansky, and he said, you know, according to you, Moshe, you should be able to have a woman president. He never dreamed about a woman rabbi, but anyhow, he said, maybe you can have a woman president. And Moshe, you know, puts him to the side, and, you know, I didn't say that, you know, but, you know, one, the logic is there, you know, if you don't have the Rambam, so maybe that's a possibility. But the Moshe doesn't acknowledge it, I should emphasize. But it's mentioned in the Tshuvas. I remember once I was riding with the car, we were learning Horius, and somebody asked the Rav, this was Golda Meir, was then the Prime Minister of Israel. So this Balbos says to her, how can Golda Meir be the president, be prime minister of Israel? As a matter of fact, they, somebody writes in this letter was to Moshe, you know, how can Golda Meir, is it, and Moshe says, did they ask me, you know, who should be the Prime Minister of Israel? but I, the Rav said, remember the Rav said, listen, I don't know, but this thing I'll tell you. If Ben Gurion was kosher, she's kosher. That's the extent of my Yom Ha'atzmaut sermon. Okay. Okay, so that's. And when we hire a shaykhid at the OU, or Seth or anybody, you know, Rabbi Mandel will check it, they'll ask him, you know, show me your Ksav Kabbalah. From who did you get Kabbalah? As a matter of fact, we had a few years ago an incident with a shaykhid who was, he was actually a Boydik, not a shaykhid, but, and he claimed that he had Kabbalah. We asked to see the Ksav Kabbalah. In fact, he produced the Ksav Kabbalah, but it was not clear on that whether it was forged or not, and therefore, to this day, it's not 100% resolved, and we didn't let him, even though he actually knew how to do the bedikus, but we didn't let him do the bedikus. You know, the shoychit, just, you know, just in the Aleph page, you know, the shoychit does the shchita, and there are five hilchah shchita, which are shia, drosha, chalada, hagroma, ikur, and they are, shia means that when shoychet shechts, he can't stop. It has to be back and forth. It can't be interrupted at all. And we're machmer, like the Ramor, even shias mashahu asas. Mikodin, it's only, it's machlok is how much the shia has to be, but as we kidei shechita, according to the Ram, it's kidei gasa, the gasa, the amount of time it takes to shech the gasa, an ox, you know, a big animal, a daka, a small animal, a goat or a sheep. Look at the gasa, the gasa, and by oaf is machloikis negmar. The Ram paskin is by oaf, also with shia apostles that it's also bedakala le oaf. Why that is strange. You would have expected to be ben oaf la oaf, especially since the Ram makes it relative in gasa la gasa. Oaf la oaf should have been dakala daka. We would have thought that oaf should also be ben oaf la oaf. So why that is a question. I deal with it in my sefer in Gan Shoshan, but it's that's the shia shia. And as a matter of fact, the Rav said the reason that the reason the shia shia is used mash, it's not just a stam chuma, because the minimum shia shchita possible is, does anybody know what's the smallest shchita? Let me ask you this. How many simonim? You know, in order to you have to shech the kon and the veshet, the esophagus and the trachea. That's by behema. By oaf, you only have to shech one or the other. L'chatchila, we shech both. Right? So, the halach is that by the koneh, with the windpipe, even if it was cut by itself, it fell on a rock and somehow was seven, which is that shchita. If the majority wasn't shevet, up to half was cut. So I only have to cut the smallest amount to bring it over to the shear rove. So that shchita is kosher. So by oaf, if you only need one simen, conceptually, what's the shortest shchita that you have? This, you know, the smallest shchita.
Little bit of
right, so it's mashu, just to bring it over. Right? By behemi, you can't have that because you have to also shech the entire veshet plus the kana. So it would have to be the full, you know, the veshet or rover the veshet and part of the kana to bring it over to rov. But on a conceptual level, the shortest shchita is the kana in by oaf, and that's why they use that as the standard for shchitas mashu. So we have shchitas. We have shia. Hagroma means that you shechted not in the assigned, so to speak, place where the shechita has to take place in the neck. That's hagroma. And as he went outside of the makom hashechita, drosa means that it wasn't a back and forth with a chopping action. You can't guillotine the animal. Ikur is machlek shushan, what ikur means either nadal du simonim, that the simonim, the Kana and Veshit were set not in their proper place during the Shechita, or Iku means Sak in Pogum, that there's a niche, not a niche, you know, the Sak is not completely smooth. And Chalada means, Chalada comes from the etymology of the word Chalada is like Chulda. Chulda is a weasel that, you know, it goes down into the holes and the hidden places, and Chalada means that the Sakin was covered during the Shechita, either by one of the Simonim or by the oar, and even we're marking it by a matlis, even by a cloth, and that's why it's important for Shechita. For example, sometimes you'll see a Shechita will hold a knife, and they'll, you know, they hold it from the handle, but they'll put their finger over the blade. That's not good for two reasons: a shalach chalada, and also it becomes a shalach of the possibility of drasa. Okay, so that's one issue I just want to speak to you about in terms of, you know, nashim shechting and the halacha of the sense of responsibility, meaning hakol. The other issue I wanted to talk to you about relates to the Lubaskim story, which unfortunately is in a terribly sad story. It began about 4.5 years ago when PETA, which is a extreme animal welfare, and I have to say, even though the word is absurd, animal rights organization, and PETA is concerned about the welfare of animals, and they came into, surreptitiously, they sent somebody into the plant in Postville, which was the only Jewish-owned in the sense of Shomer Shabbos-owned plant, and it became the largest.
It was one of them.
At that time also?
When PETA came in.
Oh, because you had
Ilan.
Okay. But most of the other places are shechting in other people's slaughterhouses. They're doing a kill within that slaughterhouse. But he was also the largest manufacturer of kosher. And they took pictures of what was happening in his slaughterhouse, if you recall. And they were very aghast at some of the things. And one of the things that really did him in was that they rotated the animal. Now, the reason they did that is that some people haven't, and this is what's required in Eretz Yisrael, is that they insist that the animal should be a shechita munachas, namely that the animal should be on its back when it's being shechted. The maila for that is that there's less of a chashash of drasa, because if the animal is standing, so if the head would collapse on the knife, the thing that would cut it would be just the pressure of the knife, not the cutting action back and forth. And in Eretz Yisrael, for example, their meaning is that they insist that the shechita be shechita munachas with the animal on its back. This became a big issue, before I get to the Bashkin story, between the United States and Israel, because Israel, which is, at least when this story emerged, when I first came to the OU in 1980, was getting about $3 billion a year in American aid. So congressmen in the Midwest were upset that Israel was buying its meat from South America or from other places that they were slaughtering and not buying it from America. But, export of meat is an important industry in the United States. So the reason that they gave always was that they insist, or they prefer, I would have to say, that the animal should be inverted. Now, I remember this issue came up also when Rav Shapira, who was he was Rav HaRashi, and also was the Rosh Yeshiva of Rav Chazal Rav Kook, very great Talmid Chacham. So, just to make you aware just of the politics of Shechita, in the 1950s, there was a federal act that was passed, which is called the Humane Slaughter Act. There were different versions of it. I think initially it was passed in 1938, it was amended again and changed in the early 60s. And the Rav of Soloveitchik was, at the time, became an advisor to the Secretary of Agriculture about these issues of religious slaughter. And he testified, as a matter of fact, in front of Congress about it. The issue whether he didn't take any money for it, but they they paid his expenses. This went up actually up to the Supreme Court of the United States, whether that was an issue that they paid his expenses. But the Rav sort of, he formulated the position of the American Jewish community, not only Orthodox. And what he did was he invested in developing a new kind of pen so they didn't have to do hoisting, you know, shackling and hoisting. Because the humane societies, especially ASPCA and others, were very much opposed to it. And the Rav, in his brilliance, saw, you know, decades ahead what would be happening, and he created this pen, and he gave it over. There was investment. Basically, what the pen that we use, the standing pen, is the animal walks into this pen. There's sort of like a hydraulic lift that lifts it up under its belly, so it immobilizes it, and its head is held in a chin lift that moves it up. So when the shoychid is shechting, he's not really shechting mil matla mala. He's really shechting sort of a little bit on a slant, balachzon. But the chash, if it's properly done, you know, that the head will collapse on the knife, is obviated. And he was so smart about it. You know what they called this pen? They called this the ASPCA pen. And they gave it over. They did the research. They gave it to the, you know, he had to buy into it. The shokta of its, you know, it's like it says in Shoftim, for 50 years, there was no discussion. There was calm, because he understood the Rav that, you know, these elements, and they're not also, I'm not talking about Peter, but, you know, some of these humane societies, when they talk about Shechita, some of them, you know, have their issue, but I'm not saying it's even the majority, but I don't think this is necessarily Peter, but there's also a level of anti-Semitism, at least in the 1950s, where the Rav was operating, and certainly nowadays in Europe, where they're trying to disallow Shechita, and in many countries, Shechita is not permitted. So, you know, that was and that's the way people shechted in America after that. The Rav got Rav Lazer Silva and Ramesh and others. This was the way Shechita took place in the United States. Till Rubashkin, I think, Rubashkin was just about the first, maybe there was some in Linden they started with a rotary pen. Maybe initially they weren't even selling to Israel, so it didn't do them very much good, but then Rabbanim Achshirim thought that this was a great idea. I thought that this was an absolutely terrible idea. The OU has been lobbying against the Shechita, not because they think it's worse than the other Shechita, but it creates enormous potential political problems, which the Rav saw, and candidly, I don't think other people see. And when Rubashkin first started, Rubashkin himself is a good person, he cares about kashrus, and what's happened to him is just an outrage. You know, I don't know if you know, but the U.S. attorney asked for a life sentence last week. A life, not 25 to life, the maximum sentence. I mean, killers don't get that. Murderers don't get that. It just, they've somehow painted him as if he's some Madoff or some mass murderer. And the level of overkill in terms of, you know, the multiplicity of charges over and over again, you know, each count. So they got it up to 86 counts or more than that. So it's really, it's just an outrage. But, you know, I told him at the time when Peter came in, this became a national story. It was in the New York Times. It was in November. I remember it was in Israel. I said, this has to be related to it. It's going to be, you know, this can have a downward slope. And, you know, Nat Lewin, I'm going to mention his name. He's a great attorney. But, you know, he says the OU let him down and so on. The one who let him down were those people, including him, who kept him, stand up for religious rights and this and this and this. They should have used the Rav's model. It would have saved him an enormous amount of aggravation. I don't want to tell you, Sholem Mordechai himself told me once, he said, if I could get out, this was go back into the plant, the first thing I'd do is tear out that pen, you know, the rotary pen. But it's inefficient, but, you know, may have some mileage if some people think. Also, his Rav HaMachshir, Rav Weissman, others often quote a shach, which is, I think in the book I gave you, it says, it's Simon Vav Sif Dalid. The rotary pen is the other pen I described, right? The rotary pen is the animal walks in, and then it's turned around.
It turns the animal on its back. It rotates 180 degrees. Once the animal is inside the pen, it closes behind it. The whole pen rotates 180 degrees so that now the animal is actually
on its back.
On its back. Facing
upside down.
Facing upside down, exactly. So first of all, it's inefficient because it takes time to rotate it one way, and then they rotate it back to get it out. So that's how the rotary pen works. It's also much more expensive to do it. But there are those who have quoted this halach. It says in Shulchan Aruch, "No itzakin because of a heavier hatsava ad shenishchot shchitasok sheva, for who she had tsava behema lamata vasakin lamala, she had tsava behema lamala mihasakin shemet teirid habehema bekovid kufa, for tachtov below halach of ava the ains of shchita." Vafilo ama bavali shelo derasti shchitasok psula. Lefikach im haya ha'ov ben shahaya tzavol amalu me'asakan hanu'utza olamat me'anashchitasok sheva. Of course, the case that the Shulchan Aruch is talking about, and then the Ramah says, not the Ramah, excuse me, I mean the Shach here says that umeviyah beisir ina dafil kashatzav behem lamata sheshchitasok tafke b'di evet v'lo lechatchila. Vafilo notzo b'dava hatolosh. So anyhow, some have misread this. That the Shach is talking about if the sakin is in us, if the sakin is lamata and the tzav is lamala, that's shchita. In other words, and is only good by the evet, but that's not what the Shach means. That the Shach means if it's what do you call it? If it, in the case of sakin the utza, the sakin is in the wall and you're moving the head over the knife, so that's more problematic than if you're controlling when you're the head is, you know, you're moving the knife, not the head over the knife, and especially when we have the most importantly when we have the chin brace that keeps the head steady, so this is not a problem. And I remember once Rav Shapiro came to my office, he spoke at the OU and he spoke about these issues, so I spoke to the Rav about it afterwards. So he told me, you should write him, tell him about this Rambam. The Rambam says in Perek Dalet from Hilchos Shechita, Here. The answer is in Halacha Zayin. Ketzet shochnu, moteach atzavu molich asakin mevia at shoychet, ben shahaisa behema mevutsu, ben shahaisa omedes, v'ochus ba'afa v'asakin v'yodim v'mata v'shochnu harezek shera. So the Rambam says mevutsu, ben omedes, ben mevutsu. So you see, you can check that if it's omedes as well. And I remember the Rav told me, write him that Rambam. So I'll just tell you, I'm going to close with this and put Rabbi Mandel on. This issue keeps percolating because the Satmar Rebbe of Williamsburg, Rabbi Aaron Teitelbaum, you know, he decided, even though his father, the Sikkata, used to shech with the regular pen and told people that's the best way to do it, and that's the way his brother, who, you know, Zamalei was doing it, but he wants to make his mark in Kashrus. So he insisted that they start Shechti for his community in Monroe in a rotary pen, which makes things complicated for others. You know, it's an upward scale here. And I told him I thought it was a very big mistake. I went to visit him together with Rabbi Belsky. I visited him several times, I'm pretty friendly with him. And I remember when I first came in, he asked me, V'habenzeke shechten the time for Moshe Rabbeinu? You know, how did they shechten the time for Moshe Rabbeinu? So I told him, basically, Obich face v'os Rabbeinu Moshe zakvegen them. But I know what the Rambam says about it. So I told him this Rambam, and I said, this is Rav Rachel pointed out this Rambam. So he tells this Gabi, bring me the Rambam. And he's Tamchoch. So he looks at the Rambam, Taka, so I shtake the Rambam, you know? So I thought, you know, we'd won the battle, Nechtekatav. Because, you know, this didn't only have to do with Rambams and Shachs and Taz, and it has to do, you know, with the Kolosher in Yonanah, the politics, I think, that's also superimposed. So he insisted with Ali processing, and the company doesn't want to do it. First of all, it's very expensive. It cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars to create the room to put the new pen in, and it's inefficient. And he had to pay for it because the owner said, "We're not going to pay for this." So I think he paid for it, and that's what they have right now. The shechter that
in one place.
In one place. In right. I mean, Ali in one place in Ali Texas.
Can you repeat the Rambam
inside? Just read. The Rambam is Perek Beis Halacha Zayin. So when it says Ketzer Shechtim, and then it says. And then he says, Ben Shahisa Behema Ravutsa, Ben Shahisa Omedes. The Ochas Ba'ofa Vasakim Yodm Mamata Vashokh Harejuk Sera. Ravutsa Omedes.
What they do before electricity, they used to put the animal on its side?
Well, that's what they're doing now in South America. They sort of wrestle the animal down. You know, the ways of doing it.
How many people does that take?
How many do it?
How do they do what?
No, he wants to know exactly that. When you get it down.
How do you flip an animal?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
How many people does it take to get a
That's what they used to do in Europe. In Europe, there were no pens.
Well, that's what they do in South America now.
You had to wrestle the animal down.
Well, that's what they do in South America right now.
Well, no. It's
because they're hoisting a shackle to get
it. They're using the shackle to aid them. In Europe, you used to get a bunch of four workers, used to lasso one leg, and the workers would jump on the animal, push it over on its side, and then one worker would hold each leg. That's what they used to do. Now in South America, to make it easier, they're grabbing one leg with a shackle, lifting the animal off balance, because the one leg is partially, the animal is a little bit up in the air, and then they let it down on the ground. And before the animal has time to get up, so the goyim come, and they use a device to pull back the head like this so that the animal can't get up.
Anyway, so this is you probably read a lot about the Rabashkin story. It all the genesis of this story starts with this Peter thing, and it's the whole
why would it not have been a problem having used the rope's pen?
Because what they videoed afterwards was if you don't cut the vredum, those are the arteries on the side, the animal can still have enough blood going to the brain that it can walk afterwards. What happened was, in a rare occasions, even if you cut the vredum, they're elastic and they can seal on themselves so that all the blood doesn't drain. And they had videos of the animal after walking around.
Because what happens is
it has a lot to do not just with the reality of the pain, a lot with the aesthetics. So when you shecht in a standing pen, the animal can't walk around afterwards. It's left in the pen for a little while, and then it's picked up immediately. So, what Peter does is it takes pictures. And they just did it last week. There was an article in last week's LA Times about it. And, you know, not every picture means that it's terrible, but for the uninitiated, you know, they see an animal walking around or they see all the blood, they think, oh, this is just absolutely horrible. But, you know, the big guru on animal welfare is a woman, very remarkable. She's somewhat autistic. Her name is Temple Grandin, and she's a professor in Colorado. And I remember once, and she sort of, we're using her because everybody agrees that she's the expert. That means the animal welfare, Peter, and she's not opposed to shechita. She's fine with shechita if it's properly done in terms of the animal welfare techniques. So remember there was once Peter had a picture of in Goshen, New York, where we shecht deer, and it said it was terrible, terrible, and they put the Peter, so who's going to, you know, who knows if you see it? No one's expert. So I sent it. So Temple Grandin said, no, that was okay, the way they were doing it. But so you'll hear her name. Anyhow, I'm going to close now. Yeah.
Question. I remember there was on the video there was talk about there was a second cut and they were pulling.
Right, initially what happened was this. First of all, they had the pictures of the animals walking around, and also they showed a picture of what they call the second cut. In other words, in order to make sure that these, you know, cardiac arteries are severed, they would cut it afterwards. And in order, these arteries are on the trachea. So they would take out the trachea in order to get to them, and that was not a good procedure.
the animals in South America, how are they not fearful? It's like when they lift it up by its leg, isn't it going to break its leg?
The answer is it doesn't. Okay. So anyhow, Sean will bash me. I want to make my comments to you just in terms of that. I spent a big part of my days, the last several years, dealing with these animal welfare issues in terms of Shechita. Rabbi Mandel does as well. And the whole episode with Lubashkin, it's sad on so many different levels. You know, he made some mistakes. He blundered in some areas. And as I indicated, I thought, you know, could have been handled differently. Basically, a good person where the federal government operated in an unprecedented fashion. Started with the story of immigration, you know, unauthorized immigrants working, illegal immigrants, which populate half the meat plants in the country. There were a similar raid in Swift. They didn't arrest the owners and so on. Here they arrested the owners and the workers, and they treated them very shabbily. They really, in terms of due process, they barely spoke English, and they, you know, skirted them through the courts, gave them 5 months, and they just moved it up and up. And it's, you know, in terms of American justice, this is, in my opinion, a terrible, terrible story. Okay, Rabbi Mandel.
Just for that, there were actually two pamphlets here. If any of you want, you don't need it now, believe me. You don't need it, but at the end, you might want to pick it up. What I'm going to be doing is talking about, we could be here for 3 hours talking about meat. You don't want that. I don't want that. There's a mitzvah of Ahavta L'Reacha L'Kameicha, and I'm going to tell you what I wish I had been told when I was in the smicha program in Reitz a long, long, long time ago. They didn't tell me then, and they're not going to tell you now, not because there's any great plot, but simply because this is one of these funny issues, like in Safrus and in Shechita. The people who know what's going on are the people who work in the field. The Rabbonim know what's going on from observing it, but they are not in charge. And you get not in charge of the way that people are doing it. And so you get these issues nowadays. The way that the Seferim write letters nowadays is not like the way anybody did it in Europe. And it's supposed to be a Maseiros. So how did it change? Long time talking about that, but there's somebody asked Reb Chaim Kamenetsky, how can he do this by himself? Reb Chaim said, well, they are the Seferim, they must know how to do this. Now, in terms of animals, there are hundreds of issues, but let's focus on 85% of the question of kashrus. Okay? The stuff that's only alluded to in two sifim, in the Shulchan Aruch. Most of the questions of kashrus are the sirchos in the lungs. Yeah, there are lots of other things that can arise and do arise on occasion and constitute the other 15% of where animals are considered not kosher. But the vast majority is because the lungs have sirchos. Sirchos are adhesions between strands of mucus, or larger than strands, that are connecting, that go from one part of the lung to another part of the lung, or to the thoracic cavity, to the diaphragm. It's referred to once in the entire Gemara, the Bavli. It's referred to, the Rava refers to it once about Reyes Zrichem, and he says there something about it. And then it becomes an issue, because what the Gemara is talking about and what the Rishonim describe come into face with the Metzias. The Metzias is like this. Any animal can have any kind of sircha. Most animals, in particular, animals which are not raised the way the Kodesh Baruch Hu intended them, namely free-range grass feeding. But animals which are in the pen, or any animal which is under stress from the weather, it's too hot, it's too cold, the animal develops stress syndrome, develops adhesions in the lungs. And these adhesions can range all the way from a very light strand of mucus to something which is really tough and hard. Even the doctors classify them in two ways, as mucus adhesions and fibrous adhesions, but from our point of view, they're all adhesions, and they run the whole spectrum. There's no line. All different kinds. Some of the adhesions you have like a ribbon of mucus from the lung to the side of the thoracic cavity. Some of them you even have the whole side of the lung that's stuck to the thoracic cavity by this big, hard strand. Now, when the Gemara says that there's a problem with sirchis, what sirchis is it talking about? And the Rishenim start dealing with this, and the way that you determine what sircha falls into what category. There's a basic machlekes of Rashi and Tosfos there about the reason why these adhesions cause a halachic problem. You know, from the trefet, from the point of view of Eila Trefes, the problem is that there might be a nekev in the lung. The halacha is that if there's a hole in the lung, a hole in the membrane of the lung, that the animal is a trefa. Now, if you discover that the lung is there and there's no hole in it, but there are these adhesions coming out of it, what does that do? And Rashi says, well, it's because there was a hole in the lung at one point, and the various mucus things inside the lung emerged, and they dried up and sealed up the hole, but that isn't good enough. Once the hole is there, the animal's trefa, and then the fact that the adhesions are sealing up, the fact that the secretions are sealing up the hole, Rashi says, are not good enough because they may come loose. Tosfos, perhaps influenced by the fact that so many animals have these adhesions, says no. You don't have to have a neke in the rea to make it trefa. The problem with these adhesions is that when you remove them to make sure that the lung is clear, it will cause a hole in the lung. And so Tosfos' reason is seife l'ninoke. This is all in the, it's referred to in the Shulchan Aruch, in the addendum I gave you, it's referred to in Simen Lamed Tes. The Noisei Kelim discuss this. Everybody discusses this. But the Maiseh, you're confronted with a dilemma. How do you determine whether an animal is kosher or not? And now I'm going to explain to you what the difficulty is and the difference between what every future rabbi should know, the difference between plain kosher, glatt kosher, and beis yosef kosher. Most people, including rabbis, are blissfully ignorant about it, and ignorance is bliss. Yes, sir.
Don't you check the lung after the animal dead?
Well, you can't check them when he's alive. He would strongly object. After the animal is dead, while the carcass is still whole, immediately after they eviscerate the animal, take out the kishkes, at that point you do what's called bedikas panim. The bodek will come with a little knife, cut a hole in the diaphragm. The diaphragm separates with the lungs from where the kishkes are. He'll make a little slit in it, put in his hand, and feel all around the lungs to feel where there are sirchis. That's bedikas panim. After that, they remove the lungs and the heart. They give the lungs to a bodek, the bodek chutz, who takes them and looks at them. That's a mitzvah.
It doesn't matter if it creates a hole at that point.
What?
Why does it matter if it creates a hole at that point? You just said Tosfos' reason is because when you take it out, it's going to create a hole.
Not you take the lungs out. When you remove the rear. When you remove the sircha.
But the animal's already dead when you're taking it out.
No, no, no. The siachah was there when the animal was alive. You're talking about metzias. When do you check the animal? The siachah was there when the animal was alive. And Tosfos says there's a siachah in there, and it will pull loose and pull a hole in the lung when the animal's alive.
You know that it hasn't pulled loose, though.
What?
You're looking at it right now, so it obviously hasn't pulled loose.
No, well, that's the whole question. You may not actually, the Tosfos view is that a siachah which is so connected to the lung that it's going to cause a hole, it's as if the lung was already
punctured.
Like the Gemara says all the time, it's already possible. You were just checking afterwards to see what kind of siachah it was. Now, there are in the thing I gave you from Yeradea in Lamites, Sivim Yud Aleph, Yud Beis, Yud Gimel, the Beis Yosef states his position as to what sorts of siachas you'd accept. And the bottom, the Ramah says, the Ramah basically says, no, none of this is really true. We do it entirely differently. Entirely differently. Okay? The Gemara says, when the Gemara in Rava says that if the siachis are kasidron, you don't have to check them, they're all kosher. Kasidron means, you know, the lung has various lobes. And if... Well, I could draw, but I'm not a good drawer. But let's say that these are the lungs, and the lungs have a lobe here and a lobe there, and the lobes lie right next to each other. Now, kasidron means you understand what a lobe is. If you pull the lung apart, or when the animal breathes, they're going to separate. And when they're not, they're lying right next to each other. Kasidron, basically, there's a whole machlekes rishenim about which particular things might count for siachis, might count for kasidron, but everybody agrees that if they're lying right next to each other, this side and that side, and they're connected by a liur, that's called kasidron. And the fact of the matter is, lots of animals, 70% of the animals, have these little adhesions between the lobes of the lungs. Most of you have them. Whenever you get sick, whenever you're in distress, you get them too. If you ever find yourself coughing, you know, not because you've got a cold in your mouth, but coughing, that's usually because you've got a mucus strand in your lungs and you're coughing to release it. It's natural. And that is the svara, why kasidron should not be considered something which is matrif the behema. And so, the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef, says, according to the Gemara, all the siachas which are right next to each other are kosher. You don't even have to check them. You don't have to look at them underwater. You don't have to examine them. The Boidek Pnim puts in his hands, feels that there's an adhesion there, feels that it's between the lobes of the lung. Fartik, we're done. It's kosher. And the only thing you have to worry about is if there's a siachah that goes from here, say, the back of it to over here. It's not the parts that are lying adjacent. Tremendous kula. According to the Beis Yosef, a lot of the animals would be kosher. Of course, nobody believes the Beis Yosef nowadays because we all know better than him. So this is... When somebody tells you Beis Yosef, it's an insult. The Rav would say it's an insult to the Rav Yosef Karoi. They're attributing to him a position which he never in his life held. He says that if they are kasidron, you don't have to worry about them at all. But if they're not kasidron, you don't take anything. The only thing you can take if it's an obvious mucus adhesion, meaning the minute you start to touch it, it breaks. And that's what the Beis Yosef says in the Shulchan Aruch. According to the Beis Yosef in the Shulchan Aruch, the percentage kosher yield of animals nowadays in slaughterhouses would probably be 50% higher. The Ramah, however, The minhag in Ashkenaz was, according to the Rishonim, that you don't accept this idea of kesidron, even though the Gemara says it. Some Rishonim say we don't know exactly how to check, and therefore, even if the Gemara says it's kosher, we can't do it unless we check it. And so, if you look in the Ramah here, the Ramah says we check every sircha in a lung, whether it's kesidron or not kesidron, and we accept the ones which we can determine are just light mucus adhesions, and here's the rub, I say. How do you determine in a scale that I described to you that you can have all sorts of adhesions from a tiny little mucus thing to a strand that you have to tug at and tug at and tug at and it still won't break? How do you determine which one is an easy one and which one is a not? And which one is not? And the Ramah says the way you determine is by mi'uch and mishmush. Mi'uch means you squish it, then mishmush means you palpitate it. And so the Ramah, and there on Siman Lamed Tes, you look at it, he says, the way you check the sirchas to see whether they're kosher or not is you take them between this adhesion, between your fingers, and you're squeezing it, and you're rubbing it around, and if it breaks at that point, it's a sign that it was not really anything, because if it was a really serious sircha, the kind that Tosfos is talking about that would break the membrane of the lung, or like Rashi was talking about, if there was already a hole in the lung, it for sure wouldn't break like that. This is just mucus. Okay? That's what the Rambam says, and that's as far as you're going to get when you're learning your Yeridea in yeshiva, and nobody does it. Nobody. Not anybody. Not Sfaradim, not Temanim, not Ashkenazim. The Rav knew how to do it, but didn't do it. Nobody does that. Now, this is a strange thing. A funny thing happened on the way to the circus. How does it happen that something which the Ramah says is the way you check has totally disappeared from off the face of the earth? Instead of that, you have a new method which is used nowadays by everybody. Come in and you look in the Shach and the Taz and you won't find any mention of it at all. This is one of these very funny, interesting things in Halakha. The first one, as far as I know, who mentions what's actually happening is Reb Zalman Margolius of Broad. This is in the mid-18th century, before it could become a bone of dissension between the Hasidim and the Snagdim. This was before that. And he notes that nobody's doing what the Ramah says. Instead, what are they doing? How do they check lungs nowadays? What happens is the Bodek Pnim inserts his hand, feels when the lung is in the animal, before they've cut open the animal, you can feel every little rear. And he notes on a little pad where he found the virin. The lung then goes with that little pad to the Bodek Chutz. The Bodek Chutz finds all the virin, and what does he do? He takes them and he peels them off very carefully off the surface of the lung. If he succeeds, if he can't pull them off, forget it, the animal's straight. Sometimes, like I said, what we call is reyes is sruha ladeifen. There's a big mass of the adhesion between the wall and the thoracic cavity. You don't even look at it. The Bodek Pnim finds it, the animal's straight, you don't look at it. In most cases, you're getting the Bodek Chutz, who has now the lungs with these ririn, and he's taking them and very carefully trying to pull them off. If he succeeds in getting them off, then he puts them in water. This already is discussed by the Gemara. You put them in water, and you inflate them with air, and you see whether it's mevatzpeitz, whether there's any air coming out where you remove the rear. Okay? That's the way the checking is done. And Reb Zalman Margolius, noting that this is not mentioned by any of the Rishonim or any of the Acharonim, says, what's going on here? The Lama, at least we understand. You're palpitating the adhesions to see how strong they are. But this method of peeling them off, what sense does it make? And I'm not going to go through, we don't have time now for me to go through the whole, the lumdus of the answer, but the Chassam Sefer says, when I grew up, the Chassam Sefer is coming not that long afterwards, and the Chassam Sefer says, when I learned all of this and went to Shlachtos and saw what the Shechtim are doing, he said, I don't know what's going on. How are they being machshir, these behemoths, by peeling it off? And he says, I was completely out of my mind until I read what Reb Zalman Margolios said. Reb Zalman Margolios said, Bekitzo, the following, remember the main question. The question is, did this come from, or is it going to lead to a hole in the lung? And what Zalman Margolios said is, if you can peel a lot off and it comes off easily, it's a semen, saivi rashi, saivi teispas, that it's not that really closely connected to the structure of the lung. It's something, some sort of membrane or adhesion that developed on the outside. The Chassam Sefer says, Gewaldig. When I saw him, my eyes were open. I saw that even if B'nai Israel are Nevi'im, they're B'nai Nevi'im, and the fact that all the Baikim are doing this nowadays, he says, this is really has a source to rest on. Until he gets to the end of the tshuva, and he says, well, if you want to be really about nefesh, maybe you should rely on this. But basically, for all the Jews, forget about that. Forget I even mentioned that, because this is what everybody does. The way of checking the lungs is by klipa, by peeling off the siachos. Now, I already told you what the problem is going to be. Since siachos come in 100,000 different shapes and sizes and varieties, at what point do you say that the siachos came off easily and can't really be connected to the structure of the lungs? You know, you have a spectrum here. Where are you going to draw the line? And how can you draw the line? And this is now, I'll add in one more thing. All of the Achroim who discuss this, after Reb Zalman Margolios, everybody discusses this. And so you find a lot of tshuvas in the late Achroim about this. You find Reb Chaim Tzanzer, you find the Baal HaTanya, you find the Tzemach Tzedek, particularly among the Hasidim, because they had their own axe to grind with Shechita, which is a subject for another shiur, and then Geshulif and Nechalef is a whole different topic. But the you find them among the Ashkenazim too, like the Chassam Sefer. You find these tshuvas, and Rabbi Yisai, from reading, even if you read the tshuvas, you're still not going to know what's going on, because this is a matter which is really, you have to see. And even if I brought you one lung, you wouldn't see. What you need to do is see the range of lungs and how you peel them off and how you distinguish between different things, between what you would call different levels and kosher entree. And this is what the difference is nowadays between what is called, quote unquote, Beis Yosef, which has nothing very much to do with the Mechaber himself, and what is called glat, and what is called plain kosher. Plain kosher is, they will battle with the siyucha. They don't care what kind of siyucha it is. They're going to try to peel it off no matter how much tugging it comes. Even though all of the achoreinim say that's not what should be done, lemaise, that's what's done in plain kosher. Now, this has important implications for people who think, well, I can eat plain kosher. Glat is just the chumrah. Glat is, yes, it started off as a chumrah, but in, you know, let me take you back. Let me take you back. This is called contemporary issues. These contemporary issues are contemporary, but they were full in force 100 and 150 years ago. Let me take you back to when I was in Kurzarhäusern. And I grew up in Boston, and the Rav had a shechita near Boston. And I am very friendly with the Rabbi Teitz now in Elizabeth. And his father, we'll talk about his father, because in Elizabeth he had 2.5 shlachtaiser. In other words, 2 shlachtaiser which were only under him, and 1 that was a joint between him and somebody else. And Reb Pinchas Teitz used to wander down to the Schlachthuis, you know, whenever he wanted to. In Europe. Where did they kill the animals? It's a little, they took the animals outside in the edge of town. There's a place to shecht, right? What do you need? A factory? How do you shecht an animal with a factory? And so, in Europe, what would happen if they came across a siocha and they weren't sure what it was? Go down to the Rav. He lives 5 blocks down that way. Call him to the Schlachthuis. He'll tell you kosher treif. Right? Easy. No glatt, no super glatt, no. What the Rav says is kosher, it's kosher. If the Rav says it's treif, it's treif. And that was the way it was back in up until the 50s, when people began discovering, the meat producers began discovering that it's much cheaper to produce meat where the animals live. And the animals don't live in New Jersey. The animals live in the Midwest. And so Rabbi Loza Meir Teitz told me a story. He said, his father used to be in charge of these Schlachthäuser that were right outside of Elizabeth. And then one of the Balabatim told him, Rabbi Teitz, I'm moving this to a brand new factory that they're building upstate New York. We'll fly you up, you come and see it. It's the same Sheikhtim, the same standards. Rabbi Teitz came up, saw it, was very satisfied, and said, I cannot continue to be machshir your products. The Balabos said, you've been with me 15 years, why not? The same shoichtim. Rabbi Teitz says, you don't understand. Here, I could drop by whenever I wanted to. Now, I need to arrange a train, a plane ticket, a driver to get there, right? How can I check up on them all the time when they're doing? They're going to be working basically on solo pilot. They're going to be driving themselves. Now, you understand that when there's not a rov there to decide whether it's kosher or treif, suddenly it all falls on the bodek, right? And anything where there's no supervision, no direct supervision, it's human nature, little by little, things change. And so what has happened nowadays is that the places that call themselves plain kosher, shechita, most of them are doing things which would not have been classified as kosher in Europe. I have seen with my own eyes, plain kosher now, it's basically because of the changes in the dynamic of the firm market, is basically confined to Hebrew National and to the Israeli shechita in South America. Now, Hebrew National, we have no negiah with. The OU has no, and so I'm not going to go into their factories and investigate what they're doing. But I do go into some of the Rabbanut factories, and there are whole ranges of differences, and I can tell you some of them meet what I was trained to do, consider plain kosher, and some of them I say, you know, why are you dealing with this? This really isn't. You're tugging too hard. And the Achronim say that if you're relying that that checking in water is basically a kula, not a chumah. And so there's a problem there. That, yes?
The Rabbanut in Israel?
Excuse me?
The Rabbanut in Israel has higher standards than this? Or is this
no, the Rabbanut in Israel produces plain kosher. That's what I said. Okay? And wide variation, because there's nobody from the Rabbanut in Israel really controlling the Shechita Avn Platz in the Shlachtois in Israel. You find some Shechtim who are very lax about what they're accepting, some Shechtim who are not. You really have to have a hands-on management if you want to have one standard. If you're just going to let the Shechtim do what they do, maybe they all started in the same place. By the end of 10 years, they're all doing different things. Okay? The Glatt started not because of this. Glatt started a long time before their modern factories. If you listen carefully to what I was saying plain kosher was fine when it was still in the small Schlachtois and the Rav was in control, and at the end of the day, for instance, there's one in St. Louis now. They shecht maybe 10 animals a week. How many animals can, how many, you know how much meat is on an animal? Can't shecht, even for a big community, you can't shecht more than 10 a week. And at the end of the day, the Rav of the city, the Rav who's in charge of the Schlachtais, can ask the Boidek what happened with each animal. And he says, oh, the first one was Reuven. Reuven had this problem. And Shimon, you don't want to talk about Shimon. His lungs were completely, you understand, 10 animals a day, and how fast are you doing them? Spending 20 minutes on each animal? You don't have a problem. He remembers everything, even if the Rav isn't there. He can tell the Rav exactly what the issue was with the animal, and the Rav can say, you know, you really shouldn't have done that, or take that animal back. Okay? But if you're in a factory that's doing 100 animals a day, and you have only a couple of minutes to check the animal, give you another little secret. If the animal has only mucus, light mucus adhesions, how long do you think it takes for the Bodek Chutz to examine it? If the animal has strong adhesions, how much time does it take for the Bodek Chutz to check it? Lemaise, plain kosher takes a lot more time than Glatt kosher, the Beis Yosef. If you're looking at it from an economic point of view, dividing the thing, plain kosher should actually be much more expensive, because that's where you're spending the time. Right? You understand it? But it's supply and demand. There are not that many people left still eating plain kosher. And the reason is exactly what I said. If you have now a modern factory, you have to have a lot more control and a lot more time, and you don't have it. The shoychtim are under pressure, maybe not from the balabos. Maybe the balabos isn't telling them you got to do so many animals per hour. But if the shoychit is spending two minutes on each animal, all the other workers are backed up, and they're looking at him. The way a meat house works is you do the number of animals that are there today. As soon as you're finished, you go home. Right? There's no, you don't work until from 9 to 5. You work from 6 o'clock until all the animals are done. And here is this here's this Boidek here, and he's holding up everybody. He's playing with things on the road, on the lungs that the Goyim know nothing about what he's doing, and they're all grumbling, you know, this guy is holding us up. So even if there isn't a Baal HaBos there, you understand, the Shoyit feels it himself. You need, so I'm saying, in that production in St. Louis, that's a production that produces plain kosher, which you could say is the way it used to be done. Most of the modern productions are not like that. Now, Glatt developed about 150 years ago, not in Lita, not in Toilin, not in Germany, not in Oberland. You know, nowadays everybody knows what's called Glatt kosher. If you had gone back 100 years and asked a butcher or a rov or a katzer in Poland or in Lita for Glatt kosher meat, he would say, come again? They never heard of it. They never heard of it. I've talked to old time, you know, they didn't know. They came to the United States and suddenly they're exposed, what's Glatt kosher? They didn't know. Glatt kosher arose in one specific area in Europe, in Unterland, Galicia. Unterland meaning the eastern section of Hungary, Galicia being the same section right next to each other. There, you can theorize that the economic conditions were not as hard, and they had more animals, and they were able to shed more animals, and they decided that they would stay away from, like the Gemara says about Bosor Shehere Beichochem, the Gemara talks about meat, maybe it meat which a Rav had a paskin about, better stay away from. And that was the basic idea about Glatt. Glatt, you really don't need the Rav to paskin on. You really don't need the Rav of the Shtot to paskin on. The Shrikhim themselves, it comes off so easily, can't be trained. Okay? That's the idea of Glatt. So the difference between plain kosher and Glatt, and I'll modify this in just a minute, but the basic idea, the way it operates nowadays, plain kosher means I don't care what kind of sircha it is. If I can remove it from the lung by peeling it off, and the lung afterwards submerged in water does not bubble, then it's plain kosher. Glatt says it has to be easy to peel off. What does it mean, easy? Well, any shoychet nowadays can tell you what's glatt and what's not glatt. But if I try to explain to you, I couldn't. That's what I'm telling you. You need a whole series of lungs in front of you, and you see the ones which can be removed this way, that's glatt. The ones which can't be removed that way, that's not glatt. And the only way you can learn that is by practicing on the lungs in the slaughterhouse. So even if I brought you in one lung or five lungs, you probably wouldn't see it. You would see what an adhesion is, but it wouldn't necessarily tell you the main thing. Now, what is called Beis Yosef, as I explained, has nothing to do with the Machabel, is saying, all right, we're following the Ramah, and we check every rear, but every siocha, but we're only going to take the siochas which are more like what the Machabel says, that you put, the Machabel says right here, that if Shaboidek Yachnis Yode Bimehemo Bizrizul Slaberifian Yadayim, the imnispoko shom hasircho shemachnis habedik yotze, then it's okay. In other words, basically like I explained to you, you put your hand in, you feel the sircho, and as soon as you feel it, it breaks off. That's what the Beis Yosef says, but since the standard that's called Beis Yosef is not really what the Mechabel says, there are also liberties taken with that. Beis Yosef, they also peel off, but it's really, really easy to peel off. Whereas Glatt is easy to peel off, this is really, really easy to peel off. That's a difference between Glatt, plain kosher, and Beis Yosef. That's also the reason why you won't find any reference to the term Glatt among the Achoinim. Because even after the Klipa developed, there was no such standard. It developed in a small place in Unterland. Nobody else knew about it. Okay? There are historical reasons why it penetrated to the United States. But Lemaise, once you have a big factory that's doing animals very quickly, you no longer in Metzias can rely on plain kosher. And the places which do plain kosher, I can tell you from my own observations, certain percentage of the animals, which the way I was taught when I learned, are really not kosher according to the Mechaber and the Ramah. Now, there's a fourth standard which is not really relevant. The Ramah says by dakes, by veal, by lamb, by goats, you don't take any sirchas at all. The theory being, when the animal is young, the sirchas are so easy anyway, you can't tell what kind of sircha it is. So any sort of sircha at all in dakes is rejected. That's called kelb neglat. It means the animal is completely 100% clean. There are no ririn at all in it. So naturally, you understand the percentage of veal that's kosher is tiny. The percentage of glatt from feedlot animals in the United States. From the beginning, when Galat started in the United States, which is in the 30s, has always been roughly around 30 to 35%, the percentage of animals that are Galat. Now, I'll tell you something here in the next 5 minutes, which nobody else has heard. I myself didn't know it until a short time ago. The Rav had two productions which he was in charge of, Morrison and Schiff, here on 42nd Street. Here on 42nd Street, the big factory of Morrison and Schiff was here on 42nd Street in the East River. And you know what they did with that plant? Instead of a kosher plant, what did they do with it? They tore it down and built the United Nations. Anyway, that's where the plant used to be. And he also had plants in Boston. The Rav used to tell people that Galat kosher is not a standard and it's ridiculous and cheating people. And I had a discussion once with the Rav's son about that. And the Rav said, the Rav had said, you know, the Rav knew that they're getting 30-35% from Galat. The Rav said, it can't be more than 12%. So I talked to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik about that, and he said, yeah, we did milch and mishmush, and you can't get more than 12%. I said, but that's not what Galat means. He says, what do you mean that's not what it means? Of course it's what it means. In other words, they didn't know about the development. I can tell you in Metzias, the Rav did not know about a lot of the political issues in Unterland. They assumed when it said glat, glat is a Yiddish word. Glat means smooth. They assumed it meant like the Ramal was saying. And so you can't get the percentages. The Rav was right. If you're doing that kind, if you're doing milch and mishmush, you would be only getting about 12%. But that's not what glat is. Glat was a standard which the Rav would have rejected because it's not based on any of the Rishonim or Achronim. It's based on how easy it is to peel off. Now, the percentages that they were getting were, just listen to the end of the story because this is a kicker. The percentages that glat were getting were what? Going back till today, from normal feedlot animals are what? 30-35%. How much was the plain kosher productions getting in those days? The ones not under the Rav. And we know the names of the rabbis who were involved, but that's not a topic for today. How much were they getting? They were getting 55-60%. Okay? And how much did the Rav get? I heard this from Chaim. The Rav never got more than 40-42%. So you understand what the Rav was calling plain kosher was actually much closer to the Galat standard than it was to what other people were calling plain kosher. And this is what I want to leave you with. Once you're in this gray area of how easy it is to peel it off, different rabbonim in different cities would have different standards. It's only natural. To get, Rabbi Isai, to get 60% with most of the animals nowadays, there's no way you can do it according to what the Achronim who know about Klippot say. You just can't do it. You can do it if you buy special treated animals who are free range and all that stuff. That you can get. But with normal animals, there's no way you can get there. But the Rav, talking about plain kosher, because the Rav didn't check glat kosher, the Rav didn't deny that standard. The Rav, when checking plain kosher, the yield he got, the silchas that he allowed, were much closer to what they call glat kosher than what the other rabbanim called plain kosher. So you understand the people, including me, who grew up under the Rav. And the standard is have the Rav HaMachshir has to be a Talmud Chochom, the Sheikhtim have to be a Reish Shamayim, and then you can allow plain kosher. But they were talking, the Rav was talking about a very different standard than some other Rabbanim practice. The Rav knew that, but that was just because, you know, other Rabbanim might not be so careful about what they're doing. What the Rav didn't know was where the standard of glatt kosher came from. By the way, they call it in Hebrew, chalak. Chalak, kosher chalak is nothing. It's just a translation of the word in Yiddish. Chalak is nothing. It doesn't mean chalak. Glatt, remember, glatt kosher is a name for a certain standard on how easy the sircha is to remove. It has nothing to do with smooth, not smooth. The only reason they call it glatt is because it's free, it's smooth enough that Rabbanim didn't have to paskin on it. Okay, that's what glatt really means, and that's what the originators of it meant. It meant it's free of questions, we wouldn't even have to ask the Rav, it's such an easy sircha to remove, we don't have to worry about it. Thank you.
If we hurry up and not have to go downstairs, we should just be getting in 2 minutes. Thank you.